4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans appear.
20,000.
Agricultural
250.
Revolution. Industrial Revolution.
60.
Great Acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Welcome to Generation Anthropocene, the program where we ask the question, what does it mean to be living in the new geologic age? I'm your host, Mike Osborne, and today's interview is with Chief Scientist of the Nature Conservancy, Peter Kariva.
My name is Jenny Rempel, and I'm here today with Peter Kariva. Peter is chief scientist at the Nature Conservancy, where he's been for the past 10 years. Before his highly acclaimed stint at the Nature Conservancy, I would say, he had a career in government, leading the Seattle-based Conservation Biology Division of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And before that, you were in academia at the University of Washington. So I'm a little curious, working at the Nature Conservancy, I've been toying with what nature means. So I don't know if we could start this off just with the question, what is nature?
So I wish you'd start me off with an easy question. But nature for me probably is nothing more than being outdoors with living organisms and enjoying the surprise of it all. So I define nature pretty broadly. Nature's my backyard. Nature's a city park. Nature's the wilderness. Nature's a beach. It's all those things for me.
And would you say that's been a view of nature that's been embodied by the Nature Conservancy since its sort of earliest days, or is that a view that's a little more novel?
You know, my view is probably a little broader than the Nature Conservancy's. But, you know, in the beginning, the Nature Conservancy was founded by foresters, by scientists from Syracuse University. And they were interested in really neat woodlots, some of the woodlots with the big, grand old trees they didn't see before. And so it was sort of a special habitat for them. And over the 60 years the conservancy has existed, that's evolved. After the what I would call the woodlot, the special plant type nature, then it went to the landscape and the habitat, and then it went to the rare species, particularly plants. And science entered through E.O. Wilson, and we have biodiversity, and nature became synonymous with biodiversity, and now we're seeing it change yet again.
And where do you see this next change going?
I think it's opening it up a little bit. It's broader. You know, people. If you went out in the street and asked people, "Do you like nature?" Probably everybody would say they do. But what they had in their mind when they said that would be all the things I said. It could be their backyard. It could be their home garden. It could be Central Park. And I think now nature is to people, the public at large, is what they experience outdoors. I think conservation organizations are broadening their definition of nature to admit that breadth, partly because it also makes scientific sense.
And have you received a good deal of pushback against this view of nature as Central Park, as your backyard? 'Cause traditionally, it's been much more about these sort of set aside large wilderness preserves. And I think a lot of what your work has done, or what you've been working on for the past few years, is trying to get more of the populace and more of the conservation organizations to realize that most people define nature more broadly.
Well, for sure. I know that you know that there's been pushback. And I think the pushback is sort of a misunderstanding. When I say the nature's in your backyard or is in Central Park, that is not to devalue the wilderness. You know, I became a biologist because of a canoe trip to wilderness a long, long time ago. I'm inspired by wilderness, but that's not the only part of nature that inspires me. And I think somehow there's a misunderstanding that to like nature in your backyard somehow means that you less like the wilderness, and I don't think that's the case at all. In fact, I think your backyard is a pathway to the wilderness.
I tend to identify myself depending on what circle I'm in or who I'm around, as alternately like a conservation biologist, an environmental scientist, a biologist. And I think these terms all carry a lot of weight and sort of different connotations. And I was just speaking with a friend who is talking about the difference between conservation and environmentalism. And he's a little older than me, he thought that identifying himself as a conservationist was much safer and less politically loaded than calling himself an environmentalist. And it's almost the opposite for me, because as a member of this generation, I kind of view conservation as something that's associated with these large wilderness preserves and something that maybe is a little different from a more nuanced, broad understanding of nature. And I was just wondering what you see as the differences between conservation and environmentalism and biology, and what does that mean sort of in terms of the rhetoric and the language moving forward?
So I think both your view and your friend's view are a little bit correct. I mean, you know, you probably read the famous essay by Richard White. What is the title of it? It's called, Are You an Environmentalist or Do You Work for a Living?
Yeah.
So I love that essay. But right now, I think that the difference between conservation and the environment is that the environment is, in environmentalism, is all about people. It's all about, you know, human health as dictated by the environment, whereas conservation is about jointly about people and nature. And that's the distinction I see between the two of them. And if it's people and nature versus all about people, you could see why there's some political overtone to the labels.
And where, most days, would you place yourself and place the Nature Conservancy between those two?
Conservation. For sure, conservation.
You say, so conservation is about valuing people and nature. I guess a lot of conservation comes down to assigning values. And sometimes I struggle with the distinction between science, because when you leave behind a career in academia, or maybe you don't leave it behind, but transition to working within the nonprofit sector, there are some real different changes. And when you're working in the conservation sphere, there's this definite value that you're working towards. And I was wondering how you see those differences when you identify yourself as a scientist versus a conservationist.
So that's it. You know, this values science dichotomy exists for everybody. And I'm sure you know in every professor you ever had that they had values, believe it or not, and it affected their science and vice versa. So the way I look at it is I value nature. I enjoy it. I want my kids to enjoy it. Science ought to be able to look unflinchingly at the facts, though. It's very hard to keep the values out of it. That's okay. But science is about, given that I value nature, given that as an assumption, what are the strategies I can use to ensure a better future for nature? So science doesn't tell me why I should value nature. Science doesn't tell me how to value nature. Science tells me what are the strategies that I might use to ensure what I value is there for future generations.
And I think that's one of the real strengths of the Nature Conservancy, is that you do have this real science-based mission where you have your underlying values, but then you're trying to use science to see how you can optimize the situation. And that science implies some real authority, but then there are also these much more community-based value systems. So I was wondering if you could just maybe even walk us through an example of how the Nature Conservancy operates when you're deciding to open a project in a new region. Do you come in knowing that there's a certain species that's threatened or endangered in that area and then trying to optimize sort of the local landscape? Or do you come in asking the local community what they want in light of the fact that there are threats, or just, I guess, what would that look like?
So I think 30 years ago, the Nature Conservancy, much like a lot of conservation, leaned a little bit towards just coming in and trying to protect the species or the habitat they were interested in. But we've learned, I think everybody has learned, that that doesn't work. And, you know, in any place we'd work, we would come in and try to understand the local value. So in Upper Michigan, where we're interested in preserving vast stretches of the forest, we recognize that forestry is an important part of a pretty depressed rural economy. So we have to find some way to keep those jobs and maintain the forest. And the goal of jobs and harvesting is every bit as important to us as the goal of conserving the forest. And we know from practical experience. And of course, scientists have shown with a lot of studies that unless the local community cares about it, the only way you'll get conservation is armed guards, and nobody wants to do it that way.
In some ways, and I think a lot of your career has been recognizing this, the environmental movement as a whole has been very marginalized politically in the U.S. And some of the new rhetoric around the Anthropocene and this new era of conservation may perhaps be based in this, in the fact that conservation and environmentalists have been pigeonholed to some extent. And I'm wondering if some of the new rhetoric around broadening our definition of nature and expanding the strategies we use comes from a certain political pragmatism and that you've been driven towards that, or whether this is something that the movement maybe would have embraced even without some of that marginalization.
For sure, the sort of enabling condition for us to go there is the political pragmatism. The fact is that with a very, very small constituency, a part of the voting public, we're not going to get anywhere. So certainly the political pragmatism. But I think there's another part of it. I think in any profession you learn you have to listen. And if I were to say the single biggest failure of the environmental movement, it's a lack of empathy for the other side and the tendency to demonize the other side. I meet loggers and fishermen and, you know, CEOs of oil and gas corporations. And they're really decent people, and they actually want the same things I want. And if we could admit that, we could start working with them. But there really is a sort of this demonization of the enemy that sometimes happened with what I would call sort of immature environmentalism.
And I think sometimes as an environmentalist, we have a tendency that's sometimes the way it feels. Are there moments when you've ever found yourself, like, looked in your head and been, oh, wow, I was demonizing the opposite side, or did that illuminate anything for you? Or has this always come kind of naturally, seeing both sides?
You know, I had one of those life-changing experiences, and the life-changing experience was when I was involved in the very, very heated spotted owl trials in Seattle. It was a federal courthouse. And, of course, these trials, there wasn't one trial. There were several trials, so they played out over 5 to 7 years. But in one of the trials I was at, I was there, and I thought I was an eco-hero. I had my Birkenstocks and my long hair, and I was pretty hip, and all my students thought I was cool. And there I was fighting for the right of the environment. But there were some loggers both at the back of the courthouse and outside on the steps, and they had signs around their placards, you know, saying, "You care more about owls than my kids." And they were carrying their kids on their shoulders, like they're at a certain age where, as a dad, you carry your kid on your shoulders. And they'd shake the kids, and the kids would cry. And it just sort of struck me that, you know, geez, you know, I ought to pause and not just think about the owl. I mean, people, if we say there's no logging, what are the loggers going to do? And it hit me because I think the children were exactly the same age as my children. And that sort of motion of where when you have the kids and, you know, you hold their shins and they're on your shoulders, that's a very that's something every parent, I think, has. And I felt a connection to the other side. And by feeling the connection to the so-called other side, it started me down this path of always questioning how self-righteous the environmental movement could be.
How do you try and express or try and convince others to be more empathetic when you're meeting with people who maybe are sort of part of the old guard of environmentalism, which has tended to be a little isolationist at times?
It's really hard to do for writing. What I've discovered is what I write doesn't do it. What I write just irritates them and makes them not empathetic with me. But I think you can do it in person. You know, because you could be empathetic to them. You could listen I've had a big feud with the founder of conservation, in a sense. A feud maybe is too strong a word, but Michael Soulais. And, you know, I know he's so angry at me for what I've written. And I wasn't angry back, but we recently met at the SCB meeting, and I heard him talk about what he was – his sadness. He's living in Colorado and the loss of wildlife. And I saw tears in his eyes. And it just made me, you know, realize how much he cared, and it was really kind of neat. So I think if you're in person, you could develop that empathy. It's a little bit hard remotely. It's a little bit hard for institutions. I think we have the biggest problem is I'm a firm believer in working with corporations. I'm not going to say corporations are people, but but they're run by people, and they're run by people often with good intentions, and there's where I have my biggest challenge getting environmentalists to have some empathy.
That's very true. I think that working with corporations can scare a lot of environmentalists away. But there does seem to be a good deal of power there. Like, who are some of these corporations that you're working with, and what are the ways TNC is moving forward with them, or the Nature Conservancy is moving forward?
You know, one of our big corporations that we're working with right now is Dow Chemical. And what in the world are you doing working with a chemical company? You know, that there's stories that it certainly has in the past been responsible for some pollution. But Dow Chemical is what I call one of those keystone species corporations that operates in, you know, over 30, almost 40 countries. The material and energy it uses are huge. So think of it as an ecologist, biologist. The impact on mineral cycles, the material cycles, and energy cycles. It uses tons of water that releases the water into the environment. It has this big ecological impact. So we work with them, yet you wouldn't think of that as, you know, your first pick for a corporation.
Peter, you've often come off as a bit of a maverick or someone who can spark debates. You mentioned at the Society for Conservation Biology meeting where you had this sort of, it's based in the science, but you can have these debates that almost get into the personal. I'm wondering, I guess, whether you're an inherently sort of combative person or that's something you welcome.
So I'm often labeled as a provocateur. And I think that's fair because my interpretation of that is I try to make people think. And what I want them to do is even question how they think. But I also question how I think. So I think about all the mistakes I've made in being a provocateur. And so I don't think of myself as combative, but I think of myself as wanting to challenge everyone to question how they think.
Yeah. Part of this sort of the Anthropocene era rhetoric around conservation is this message, which I think you've been one of the forebearers of, that nature is resilient, and that in many cases, it's not nearly as apocalyptic as scientists or conservationists have made it out to be in the past. But the danger of avoiding the alarmist rhetoric is that sometimes you can go too far in the opposite direction and people become complacent. And when we're looking at these issues that span decades, that where we won't see really some of the big impacts of climate change or sea level rise for several decades into the future, people can really just become complacent. So I was wondering how you toe the line between this sort of alarmist rhetoric and something that can generate complacency or even allow big business interests to sort of go to town with your words.
So they certainly, what you've just laid out very well is there's two extremes. One is what I would call the apocaholics, and we know where that goes. And the other extreme would be the laissez-faire, and just, you know, let it be, and nature will be fine. Both of those extremes are indefensible. So it is about finding a middle ground. When I say nature's resilient, what I mean to say is don't assume it's fragile. Actually, go in with an open mind and look at the data and ask yourself, what's the evidence show? Have they recovered? What will really be lost? What's the time scale of the loss? And if you do that, I think the right answer will be you'll find out in some cases you should really draw the line in the sand and not negotiate. That will be the outcome. And in other cases, you could tolerate a lot of mining, maybe a lot of oil drilling, maybe even a lot of fracking or something like that. In some cases, maybe you could tolerate some of these things, and the threat to nature is not that great. The point is not to assume either. You shouldn't assume either that it's fragile or it's resilient. You have to keep an open mind and follow the evidence.
And one of the ways you're following the evidence is with the Natural Capital Project, if I'm
right.
Correct. Would you talk to me a little bit about what that entails and who you're collaborating with on the project?
Sure. So the Natural Capital Project is really the inspiration of Gretchen Daly, a professor at Stanford. And initially, it was just about a science project. And the science project was to bring the ecosystem services science together and see what we knew about the scientifically about the economic value of nature. It changed from a science project to an actual let's make a difference in the world project as we got the Nature Conservancy and WWF involved. And the idea here is that if you go out and in a consistent and fairly straightforward way identify and quantify the values of nature, the value it delivers to humans. It could be dollar value. It could be inspiration value. It could be spiritual value. It could be clean water value. It's not always dollars. If you quantify that and you put that on the table, you will start making smarter decisions. And I think we've seen that.
And the way the project works, it's kind of a mapping exercise, if I'm not mistaken, where you're trying to quantify all of these different values for decision makers who are then sort of deciding between what type of conservation strategy they might use or what type of development approach they might use. And how does that often play out? Like, or where is this playing out? What would be an example?
So it's a mapping exercise because where humans act on the planet, we do it in real places. That's why it's a mapping exercise. And so what you basically play out is you have a map of the landscape or the riverscape or the coastal scape as it is today. And then you ask yourself, what might humans do on this landscape or coastal scape or seascape? Well, we could build hotels. We could build levees. We could put in a Dow chemical plant. We could cut down the trees and put in a coffee plantation. So we act in these maps. And then what the Natural Capital Project does is it uses fairly simple models to quantify, as a result of how we act on that map, what changes in ecosystem services. When you put those hotels along the beach, do you get more or less storm protection? When you put in Dow chemical, do you get more or less clean water? And so it's the combination of the maps and the human action in real places and then quantifying what difference it makes that is very, very powerful. Whenever you show these maps to people, they love it. And people, I think, love maps of anything, no matter what. But maps are no longer abstract. You could show a map of a different future for a community or for a landscape or for a county. And associated with those maps, you could tally up whatever the people are interested in. You could tally up jobs. You could tally up dollars. You could tally up reliable water supply. And it works.
But that implies some tallying. And at times, it gets into monetizing these ecosystem services against to compare them to alternate futures or management strategies for a landscape. And I guess I'm wondering a little bit about how you factor in some of these more, they're usually termed within the lingo of ecosystem services, cultural or aesthetic services. But for me, there's a lot of sort of history around this just almost nostalgic valuing or symbolic value to ecosystems or to populations or species. And those just seem to me so difficult to quantify in any term. Like even if you're not using dollar symbols, they're just really hard intrinsically to quantify. So I was wondering how those come into play in these mapping exercises or if they ever even come to the monetizing stage.
So here's the first real shocker from the Natural Capital Project. You know, we hired three or four economists, gave them good jobs, had them write papers, wrote a book with a lot of economics in it. As far as I can know, in every real-world engagement that we've been in, we've never, never been asked to go to the dollar value, which is just – I mean, think about that. We've never been asked to go to the dollar value, even though we could. It was sufficient just to lay out things like water or fish produced or storm protection. We didn't have to have one magic number that summed it up, because people are more sophisticated, we give them credit for. They can juggle those different values. I think the other point you're getting at with your question, though, is there is this sort of notion of protecting species because it's the right thing to do. I do admit to that. You don't want to take this exercise to such an extreme that it crowds out all other values. Ecosystem services is not a religion by which to live your life. It's a decision support tool. That's all it is. It's not a life path via a religion. I actually, you know, see it a little bit differently. This would certainly not be the Nature Conservancy's view. But the way I think about it is, you brought up the word nostalgia a little bit earlier. Conservation sometimes can feel a little nostalgic, and I'm sometimes told that I should honor the past. I've been told that more. And I say, honor the past, I'd rather build the future. And I think what conservation, maybe a good thing for conservation to consider is, don't be a special interest. We all want a better future. Part of that better future will include nature and a pretty healthy nature, and just make it clear to people how that healthy nature contributes to your better future.
I like this idea of nostalgia or that maybe there's too much history in conservation. There's been a lot of emphasis on baselines in the past. And part of what I think you are getting at is this idea that moving forward, there are so many changing variables under climate change and global environmental change that we're really seeing novel ecosystem arrangements. And I guess in this new world where what we're pushing towards is almost designer ecosystems or designer landscapes, is there a role for history or for this historical tether?
So, I mean, I'm a great fan of history because I love to read history books. But I see history. History teaches us about constraints. And it teaches us about, you know, what is possible. What are the limits in the past that are possible? And how have humans either exceeded those limits or expanded those limits? So I turn to history to learn things, but I don't turn to history to define the future. I certainly don't do that. And you know, if you were to look at in the United States recovery plans for endangered species, most of those recovery plans, I'm sure well over a half, have as goals something that is with respect to historical populations, historical flows, historical this, historical that. That's how they're defining their goals. And I don't buy that.
But at some point, and this is the interesting part about conservation, is that it is so tied back to values. Someone, society, you said, is making those value judgments about where we want to go. How do you ensure that everyone in a community or a nation, how do you ensure that those values are representative and not just coming from sort of the conservation movement or some other subset of the population?
Well, that's the job of civil society and government and democracy to ensure that. But you're very right to draw attention to the fact that once you surrender history as determining what you should do, then you really open a can of worms, because then it really is a decision of values in society. And I think that's okay.
I want to return to this concept of the Anthropocene and ask you what you think that means, where we're headed, and when it began.
So, boy, there's so many different answers to when it began, but I think the Anthropocene began when humans evolved. I think we've so dominated the planet. I often ask the question, do we have too many people on a planet? And inevitably, everybody nods their head and says yes, especially in my circles, conservation circles. Well, in the Pleistocene, you know, we had maybe 1 million people in the whole planet, maybe 100,000 in North America, and it was one of the biggest mass extinctions ever. And so in the Pleistocene, we were already in an Anthropocene when the humans, you know, just wreaked havoc on the large vertebrate megafauna of North America. So I think we've been in the Anthropocene since the dawn of humanity. What it means going forward is with population growth and technology, our impact has grown and grown and grown and grown. And now you use the phrase designer world. Now we are in a situation where we have such dominion over the planet that we can actually decide what we want to do with it. I don't think in the Pleistocene, even though you know, our ancestors caused that mass extinction, they could decide what to do with the planet. Now we have that. And that's a tremendous responsibility, but it's also a tremendous opportunity. And so that's, to me, the Anthropocene means it's in our hands. And if we're smart, we could have a very, very good planet with a lot of wild areas, enough food, enough energy. And if we're not smart, we're going to blow it. And it's all going to play out in the next 20 to 30 years.
Well, thanks so much for coming in today, Peter.
Great.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Generation Anthropocene. We want to thank all of the students and subjects who contributed to this project. And you can find the full-length interviews at our website, stanford.edu/group/Anthropocene. Thanks to Maserati for letting us use their song Monoliths. A very special thanks to co-producer Tom Hayden for feedback, guidance, and inspiration. Thanks also to Julie Kennedy in the Earth Systems Program. And thanks to KZSU Studios Stanford, where all of our interviews were recorded. History is accelerating, and you're a part of it too. Where would you draw the line?